You are back with the conversation. You know, who hasn't heard a story about Hawaii's menehune? Hear an unexplained hum in the forest, can't find something you just put down? We'll blame the disappearance on the menehune. The Menehune Mystery is a new book written by former newspaper journalist Jan ten Bruggenkate. He tells us that Kauai is really the heart of menehune culture. So what compelled him to take on the stories of these mischievous spirits? Well, turns out he's had menehune on his mind for a very long time.
What got me started was actually a visit to Rapa Nui, Easter Island, and crouching alongside the base of Ahu Vinapu, which is a foundation for a platform that had the carved statues for which Rapa Nui is famous on it. And the stones were fitted together in a way that reminded me of what we call the Menehune Ditch, Kikiaola, on the west side of Kauai. The stonework was very similar, the seams were similar, and I thought, this is strange. I mean, we're 3,000 or so miles apart, and I'm seeing the same stonework. What could that mean? And I started looking into, initially, the stonework, and that led to the story of the Menehune having built that waterway on the west side of Kauai, on the Waimea River. And I just kept on chasing the story because it got deeper and deeper.
Well, I love that you have a little chapter on, you know, other little people in the Pacific. Because for me, growing up in Guam, I always heard the stories of the, you know, the duendes. We had little little spirits who were little troublemakers. And so when I came to Hawaii, I thought, oh, menehune, everybody's got, you know, these little pranksters.
Well, it's remarkable. Almost every human culture has some tradition of little people who are sometimes a little bit magical, sometimes only certain people can see them, sometimes they're troublemakers, sometimes they're family helpers. But, you know, you've got the leprechauns certainly in Ireland, and you've got gnomes in Viking territories, and one culture after another seems to have stories about little people. One of the things that was interesting is I started researching. I mean, one of the great tools that's available to me, I mean, the great book on the story of the Menehune is a 1951 book by Catherine Luamala, Bishop Museum publication, and she mentions in the book that she was only able to research as far back as 1885, which is quite a ways back, but she knew that there would be more information available earlier than that, and the remarkable work of the digitization of the Hawaiian language newspapers is a resource that's available to scholars today. And so I was able to look at the Hawaiian language newspapers dating back into the 30s. The 1830s. And the interesting thing was that the word menehune doesn't exist in the Hawaiian language newspapers before 1860. And then I went back and looked at the Hawaiian dictionary, done, I think, by Andrews in 1849 or so, and the word menehune isn't in it. And then I went back into, read every book I could find about Hawaii before 1850, and there's no menehune. So, you know, what could that mean? And that was a new puzzle that I set out to try and make sense of. It's it's a fascinating story. And you know, you have people today who, I mean, I interviewed people for this book who absolutely insist that they are descended from the Menehune. You know, and I don't doubt them. I just think that before 1850, those early people were known by a different name. Potentially. It's also true that in the earliest years of the storytelling in the 1860s, you have two major traditions. One comes out of Kauai and one comes out of Oahu. And the Kauai tradition has the people always being a little bit magical, a little bit associated with the forest. And the Oahu tradition, there's no indication that they're anything other than full-size humans who do remarkable stonework. They're builders. They build heiau, they build houses. They do a range of things, but there's no indication that they're small. And that actually doesn't show up for another couple of decades. And then you can track from story to story how each story changed and how the new storyteller took the changes of the one before him or her and added. So the Menehune initially were full-size adults, and then somebody called them dwarves. And dwarves are still human, they're just small. And then somebody else called them elves, which, of course, now elves are kind of magical. and then someone else gave them the ability to become invisible to certain people, and somebody else gave them the power to turn things into stone, and just one thing after another, and each story added on the last, and until probably about 1900, we would the Menahuni that people were talking about then is the one we recognize today. But that's a very different Menahuni than the one 40 years earlier.
And this whole idea of the Menahuni as masons, I was just struck by the beautiful stonework.
Yeah, there are a couple of pieces to that story. One of them is the great scholars of the late 1800s and early 1900s, Fornander in the 1800s, and Kenneth Emery as an example, and Peter Buck, Te Rangi Hiroa, in the early 1900s, tried to make sense of that whole story. And their suggestion was that the Menahuni was just a name for the earliest people in Hawaii, the earlier folks who, when later higher-ranking people came, ended up being the working class, the specialized labor. And I can remember years ago talking to the late Bill Kikuchi, who's a Kauai archaeologist, died a few years ago. And he said, his sense was that the great Menahuni works on Kauai were probably made by a construction crew that went to place from place to place doing things, and that perhaps even the same construction crew that built the Alakoko fish pond, otherwise known as the Menahuni fish pond, and built the Kikiaola, otherwise known as the Menahuni ditch, that they were just normal Hawaiians, but they were construction workers. Masons. The other piece of it is that to suggest that normal Hawaiians could not have done that work is a level of racism. And you actually read this a lot in the 1930s, 1940s, that normal Hawaiians could not have done something as complicated as building the ditch at the cut stone-lined ditch at Waimea Valley on Kauai. And of course they could. I mean, this was Hawaiians were a Stone Age culture with some of the most sophisticated abilities in woodworking and stonework, that existed anywhere in the Pacific. And, for people who could make stone weapons and shape them and make stone ulumaika bowling stones and who could make stone images and make dishware out of stone, making a square block would have been child's play. Nothing special about it, but they only did it when they needed to do it. And in the case of the ditch at Waimea, they were faced with a steep cliff that they had to bring water around. And rounded stones would not have held up in that application, so they squared off the stones and used those to build a platform. The British Voyager Vancouver went and saw it in the late 1700s and describes it as a really remarkable structure. He said it was 27 feet high and so sturdy that people used the top of the ditch wall as the walkway for getting into the upper valley. Unfortunately, most of that is now buried because a road was built around it. And what you see today, I'm told by old-timers in Waimea, is the old inner wall of the original ditch.
Huh. So is there anything about this Menahuni mystery that you came away with?
Well, one of the things is that there's this interesting term, Menahuni, which didn't exist, at least isn't in the literature before 1860. But in some ways, there are similarities to a Tahitian term that does still exist, which is Manahune. That simply refers to lower class people, people of not free individuals who don't own land. The equivalent in the Hawaiian language would be Makai Nana. And it's conceivable that the name was adopted from Tahiti in a time when there was a lot of travel. Missionary and whalers and other folks traveled between Hawaii and Tahiti and throughout the Pacific. During that period, that name was brought in and then used as a term that was sort of stuck onto existing stories. So you had the story on Kauai, these magical beings called Melehuna. On Oahu, the term Menahune shows up fairly early for normal-sized humans who do kind of work. My sense is that probably those two, when the Hawaiian language newspapers began getting distributed and people saw each other's stories, that those two roots sort of grew together into a trunk that became the Menahune legend.
We've been talking to Jan Ten Bruggenkate, talking about his new book entitled Menahune Mystery, Original Tales and Origins of the Myth. You know, full circle, 200 years later, as part of the buildup to mark the bicentennial of the missionary's arrival in the islands, the Mission House Museum and Archives has launched a living history program. It's a traveling show highlighting the Hawaii connection and the first Hawaiian missionary, Henry Opukahaia. We talked to the director of the museum, Neil Hitch, as an ensemble of Hawaii actors is now traveling the East Coast to share this Hawaii story. One of the highlights will include a dramatic performance by Moses Goods as Opukahaia on a historic whaling ship, the Charles Morgan. It's the last ship of its kind from that era.
This is the fourth show in 27 shows that we will be doing in a row.
It's quite a lineup, and I saw that you folks will actually be on the Charles Morgan, on that whaling ship at Mystic Seaport.
Yes, I think that, so the Mystic Seaport is going to be one of the best days of the tour that we are doing through New England. And we're going to be able to have access to the archive, and they've got some Hawaii collections in their archive. And we're doing a special tour of their planetarium, and they do a Hawaii Wayfinder program in their planetarium there. And we'll tour the Charles Morgan. Unfortunately, in the latest round of planning there, they did some, I think, some like fire egress issues of performing on the boat itself, and so we just were informed we're going to be on a small outdoor stage out off of the ship, but right next to the ship. But the Charles Morgan is a significant artifact. It's the only artifact of maritime whaling industry that actually sailed between New England and Hawaii. So when we talk about making this connection of Hawaii to New England, the Charles Morgan is an artifact of that connection, the last one.
It's a magnificent ship. I've seen video of it when it was out on the ocean. It was just spectacular.
Yeah, we're really excited about being at Mystic Seaport Museum. They've planned kind of a whole day around a visit by people from Hawaii and then this program.
Yes, because I know they've got manifests, names of people, you know, from the Pacific, throughout the Pacific, that worked on those whaling ships.
Yeah, and we were also we're going to be doing a presentation or a symposium at the Pequot Museum on October 11th. And in conversation with them, one of a history that I really didn't know, but there's a real history of Native Americans from New England sailing to Hawaii on whaling vessels, and Hawaiians sailing to New England on those vessels. And so in the native communities, they have a kind of a deep understanding of this exchange between the communities over a long period of time.
Gosh, I wasn't aware of that either. That's interesting.
Yeah, I was not. But they again, in talking with the Native American community about this symposium, kind of these ideas came out that were really intriguing to me. And there's a real connection at this exchange level between Native Americans on the East Coast and Hawaii. And the October 11th event is really about continuing that exchange.
And you're all over. I mean, you're at Andover, just everywhere. You're over there in Maine, Wellesley.
We have been in Yale for 3 days at Yale University. We leave from here. We're up into Andover for the next 2 days. We're traveling right now on this leg of the trip. Dr. Noelani Arista is with us at the next four venues are with a Massachusetts Humanities Discussion Series grant, which is looking at a deeper humanities discussion around the connection between New England and Hawaii. And so she's going to be discussing her new book, The Kingdom and the Republic. And at each of these venues, there will be a New England scholar also discussing their work. Paige Roberts is the archivist at Andover, and she has kind of the archives of what would be the old Andover Theological Seminary, which where many missionaries that came to Hawaii were trained. And we'll be at Williams College. Dr. Kalani Polzak hat last year. She is a professor of art at Williams College, and she hosted a Hawaii artifacts exhibit of artifacts that were found in the basement of a dorm that no one kind of even knew they had. But there was a whole collection of Hawaiian artifacts that students had brought back on trips to Hawaii. And we're at the American Antiquarian Society, and John Demos will be there talking about his work on the Heathen School, which was the foreign mission school in Cornwall, where all of the Hawaiians who came back with the first company were enrolled and graduates of the foreign mission school, as well as Opakahia, who passed in Cornwall and was buried in Cornwall.
You know, it was interesting because I happened to be at Kahikula Church on the Big Island when his remains came to rest there on the Big Island. And then sometime after, I happened to talk to the kahu over at a church here on Oahu, and he said he presided over the services before they sent his remains back over in Cornwall. So it was a really nice full circle. It was a nice connect.
Yeah, we were in Cornwall at the gravesite last week, and to pay our respects. Also, I think it's pretty hallowed ground there, and we have a lot of discussion over the last 4 days with people, because there's a lot of people in Goshen and Cornwall that still not just remember, but were involved in the bringing Opakahia back in 93. And we had one gentleman that was at Cornwall was had been at the sesquicentennial event 150 years ago and was at the disinterment of Opakahia, and brought a lot of information about those things to share with us when we were at Goshen on Sunday, this past Sunday. So I think there's still, there's people here really connected to this story. And I kind of knew that on coming, but I didn't know the depth of their passion. It's been amazing. We've had amazing crowds. Last night, Moses Goods received a standing ovation that just did not stop. And it was just a crowd at the New Haven Historical Society at New Haven Museum that really appreciated the strength of the program that he has written and kind of the connection. And we're hearing this one thing over and over, and that's seeing the one person performance, seeing Moses Goods portray Opakahia humanizes him. It makes him a person, not just a picture, not just what you read, not just sitting at the gravesite, but the person has come alive. And that was the whole intent of this program we're doing.
Well, so if any of the Hawaii folks happen to be on the East Coast over the next couple of weeks, they're going to be in for a treat if they can make any of these events.
That's true. I know there's a large contingent, probably 30 to 40 people that I know of who are coming. There's at least 20 people coming from Kauai Hau Church for the events in Boston on October 20th to October 23rd. Kahu Ken Makuakane and Dr. Ipa Wong are going to be preaching in Hawaiian from the pulpit at Park Street Church on Sunday, October 20th. I think this is probably the first time in 200 years that Hawaiian has been preached from the pulpit, and it really is a full circle. It is, you know, close to the day that missionaries left Park Street to come to Hawaii, and we've gone through a 200-year period that's been pretty contested and tumultuous, and it's almost as if now it's a full circle where Hawaiians are coming back to preach in Hawaiian at Park Street. It's really going to be a significant event, I think.
Yep, chicken skin, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know of lots of people that are coming for that. So we're excited. We at Hawaiian Mission Houses are excited to be a small part of that. I don't really consider this our event. I think this is something that we have tried to organize and have worked hard to make happen. But this is really about a bigger kind of idea than any one museum could do itself. This story is at its core a Hawaiian story. It is at its core, it is Hawaiian history. And what we would like to do is present a program that kind of put that focus back on a history that I think for a long time was kind of used by others for their own purposes. And we tend to forget that, like, at the heart of all this, Opukahia was a displaced Hawaiian young man searching for family and searching for something to believe in and searching to get home.
That was Neil Hitch, head of the Mission House's historic site, talking to us from New England about a series of living history programs underway as we mark the impact of the arrival of missionaries in the islands some 200 years ago. You know, joining us for today's reality check is Honolulu Civil Beats Stuart Yurton. He's got a story that he wrote with Brittany Light on the idea of a green fee for tourists that would help offset tourism's cost to the environment. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
You know, your story starts off with the Palau Pledge, which is a pledge that the visitors make when they step foot on the island to tread lightly. And they also get charged a fee, a green fee.
Exactly. No, then it's something that people here in Hawaii are seriously talking about. Conservation International, a non-governmental organization that does a lot of work in conservation, the environment, is presenting a big paper at the Hawaii Executive Conference this week, today actually, on the Big Island, big conference with Hawaii executives, and this is going to be before some really important decision makers.
Yeah, because I know they were looking at that Palau Pledge as a model. Just for getting people to be more respectful, but this fee is something to consider.
Well, it is, and it's one of the tools that people are saying we can use. Again, we have these negative side effects of lots of people coming here. You know, normally the way to deal with these kinds of negative externalities is with some kind of tax or fee. That's really what we're thinking about here. A lot of places internationally have started doing it. Palau, as you mentioned, Galapagos, Bhutan has something. The Spanish island of Mallorca, lots of places are adopting this.
I can see, though, there might be some concern, you know, that the fund that they're putting into, though, gets used for environmental issues and to offset tourism and not for something else.
Well, that's definitely a concern. One of the ideas is to have some kind of public-private partnership, manage the money. I mean, it could be directed by whatever legislation sets it up, could direct it to go to a certain place. Those are details that people are definitely concerned about.
Well, we have seen over the years how lawmakers like to raid funds, right? So,
yes, we have. And yes, that's definitely a concern. I mean, another idea, aside from imposing a new fee, would be to take existing money from, say, the tourism tax or the hotel tax, known as the TAT, and steering that to conservation. So that would be another attempt to grab money or take money from one thing and steer it somewhere else.
Right. And with all these green goals, I know we've got to do something, you know, because the sheer numbers are really impacting the local lifestyle and the quality of life. And so some people say, yeah, let's do something. Let's try something.
Yeah. And that's the plan. And again, there are some obstacles. There's the U.S. Constitution, which has some limits what we can do as opposed to, say, what a nation like Palau could do. But again, there are workarounds and all of that. It seems doable.
And so this tax on a tourist, I mean, I don't know if you got any feedback from the tourists. What do they think?
Well, you know, we have not asked the tourists, but there was a study done. It's mentioned in the report, and people generally, tourists are not opposed to it. If they're told that, look, money, You can spend a little extra money, $30 or whatever it is, and it's going to go to protect this beautiful place that you're enjoying. Researchers have found that, yeah, tourists are willing to do it, that it's a reasonable thing. As you said, though, it probably needs to make sure that it actually goes to preserving the beautiful place that the tourists are enjoying and not just going into some fund.
Okay, and then any other feedback from the businesses?
Not yet. We're waiting to hear. People have been a little leery, but the fact that they're willing to entertain this and at least give these people a serious platform is pretty interesting.
Okay. All right. We'll just have to see what the reaction is. But thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you.
That was our reality check today featuring business reporter Stuart Yurton. You can read his story online at civilbeat.org. You know, one of our fun features on this show is the Hawaii Garden and Forest segment. And today, we rebroadcast a story where we reached out across the Pacific to learn about ohia-like trees growing in California and New Zealand. The species known as the New Zealand Christmas tree, or pohutukawa, gets people from Hawaii excited when they see them growing on the streets of San Francisco. Kumuhula Patrick Makuakani, who lives in the city by the bay, talked to us about how delighted he is because he's got one growing in his yard.
So they're not ohia trees, although they look like ohia trees. And as my kumu said, close enough. And when you're a hula dancer and you need to make a lei po or any kind of lei, and those trees with those blossoms, I mean, they're the ones from Aotearoa, right? They're called pohutukawa. So they look like lehua. They look like ohia. And they're everywhere. In fact, in the house that I bought, thank God, before the whole market went cuckoo, is a huge lehua tree in front of my house. So
red or yellow?
Red.
Red.
Oh. Only get two yellow, and I know what both of them are, and I will never give that information up. But most of them are red, and so when I open my door every morning, that's what greets me. And for me, it's just every morning I get that. Although it doesn't bloom, it's not in bloom throughout the year. But just to have that as like a way to kiss me every morning to say hello is the best. And then drive down my street, tons, plenty more trees. And then when I go through the mission in this district, I mean, they're everywhere. I'm surprised I haven't gotten into an accident looking at all these trees. But I have parked my truck underneath them and made a lei while I was eating a burrito.
Oh, okay. But now are you going to do a hula?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, I should write a mele about all this lehua in San Francisco. So it should be coming out sometime soon.
Okay, burritos and ohia lei. That was Kumuhula Patrick Makuakani talking about the trees in San Francisco that are believed to be the ancestors of our native Hawaiian ohia trees. That conversation got us to wondering about the threat to the New Zealand trees. We reached out to USDA's Lisa Keith about new plant pathology research that's been underway here in the islands.
We actually have a collaborative project with researchers in New Zealand to see if their native Metrosideros, which is Metrosideros excelsa, or the pohutukawa, is vulnerable to attack by these two new rod fungi that are attacking ohia here. You know, even for our varieties and species here, we're trying to get a bigger picture of how bad will rapid ohia deaths actually get, and is it possible that ohia or the New Zealand species, do they have natural resistance? So we've started a program. We've actually received seeds from a variety of locations in New Zealand, and we've grown them out, propagated them, grown them up to the right size to actually do inoculation studies to see if it will succumb to disease, if we can see symptoms when we put in the Ceratocystis fungi.
So tell us about that plant in New Zealand, because I've also heard it referred to as the New Zealand Christmas tree.
Right. It's kind of interesting. You know, after doing some research, really, to get a better understanding of their native Metrosideros, it was very plentiful. I mean, it made up, a large portion of their forests. But because of invasive species, some animals, some introduced pests, apparently, maybe since the 90s, they've lost close to 95% of their ohia-like trees.
That's terrible.
Their native trees, yes. So, you know, for them, just like for us, I mean, they're really a sign of strength and beauty, and these huge trees that exist kind of on their coastlines. They do very well on the cliffs. You know, there's not a lot left. So really, the protection of them from anything that might be newly introduced, trying to get a better idea if that's something to worry about for these trees.
Are they a protected species in New Zealand? Or
endangered? Yeah, they're highly protected, and you know, they're trying to propagate and replant and really conserve, just like we are here.
Now, they are growing all over San Francisco. The city has planted them as a street tree, and they're very popular, and they do really well over there.
Yes, that is true. As a landscape tree, you know, in various locations, and some of the trees get very, very large. So, you know, it would be good to know if, again, the Ceratocystis fungi get to California or they're introduced into New Zealand, what will happen to these Metrosideros excelsa trees.
So where do we have the young plants growing, the seedlings that where you're doing the research? Is it there on the Big Island or here on Oahu?
Yeah, so actually in the USDA Agricultural Research Service facility in Hilo, in our greenhouse, we've propagated the plants. We have many, many healthy plants. The first experiments have gotten started. Right now, it's more than 10 weeks into the process, and kind of a side-by-side comparison. If we inoculate healthy seedlings of the Metrosideros excelsa from New Zealand, along with the Metrosideros polymorpha from Hawaii, which we know are susceptible, you know, we kind of watch and wait to see what is happening. And so far, unfortunately, as we knew, our ohia are susceptible. So we're starting to see wilt symptoms already. Actually, within the month, we started to see some symptoms. But more than 10 weeks now, right now, the seedlings from New Zealand still look really healthy. You know, it's a test in progress, kind of the first test of its kind. So it's really just to wait and see what's going to happen.
So it might be they have a natural immunity?
Yeah, we're hoping that, you know, maybe there's enough of a genetic difference to actually be resistant or extremely tolerant, as in, even though there might be some minor setback in health, it will not actually die and could potentially overcome the fungus and, you know, not actually come down with disease.
Is there any way to, like, inoculate our trees or, you know, kind of like a vaccine?
That's a really great question. You know, in some other plant diseases, they use kind of a less virulent strain where it's almost like what you mentioned, a vaccine. You know, it's too early to tell with us. We have isolated hundreds and hundreds of different isolates or the fungi, but from various locations infecting trees. And when you look at them, we're just starting to try to get a better understanding if they're all really genetically similar and can they all cause disease in the same time and manner. So it'd be nice to think maybe there are some strains that are less virulent and could serve that purpose, but definitely good research for the future.
So who contacted whom? Did we contact the New Zealand government or did they make the overtures to us?
Well, I was invited to a biosecurity meeting in New Zealand once word of our new disease started to spread. The concern was there. The similarity for our native Metrosideros is there. Some of it was actually just doing some collaboration to make sure that biosecurity at their borders, they know what to look for, how to test for our fungi, and then making connections. You know, they don't want our fungus going there to test. So the idea was to send their plant material to us to test.
And do we have any of their ohia here?
You know, there are some nursery varieties, but it turns out that they're not purely excelsa. Some of them are actually hybrids of more than one species. So, you know, we did some preliminary work with as many nursery varieties that we could get our hands on just to kind of get that first glimpse. Is it possible that there's tolerance, you know, in those species? And it looked promising. So that's why we really wanted to continue getting pure stock, pure seeds from New Zealand specifically, that they know the genetics behind it, they know the locations where these mother trees are located, and then we can work with that material.
Would there be any reason to do any research with the ohia trees in San Francisco?
I think we've probably got it covered to get started. You know, if the test proves to show that there is definite tolerance or even resistance, you know, we could try to figure out what type of varieties are planted there. You know, and that's then just work to come. Like I mentioned, there's other species of Metrosideros in the state of Hawaii. There's other species in New Zealand. And probably the best idea would be to gather the material from specific locations again, so you know the lineage or genealogy of the plant material that you're working with. You know, it's really the start of a much bigger screening program with a larger collaboration here with Forest Service and also with Forest Service on the mainland. I mean, it's really garnering a lot of attention because it is so critical. I mean, information is critical to know, again, how bad can it be here when it comes to restoration, you know, for landscaping purposes, for biocultural applications. We really need to know, well, what is the potential outcome if the fungi spread? So it's really the tip of the iceberg of a much bigger program, but it's really exciting, you know, and definitely hopeful. So that's kind of a bright spot when it comes to this devastating disease.
That was plant pathologist Lisa Keith from the USDA office in Hilo. We're sharing a rebroadcast of a conversation we had about research underway to determine if our rapid ohia death disease could impact New Zealand's native pohutukawa trees. Thanks for joining us on The Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz.